Thank you very much, Dean Hurd, Chancellor Herman, Carl Vacchetta. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your warm reception and for your presence here today. It's a great honor for me to be able to participate in this lecture series as the chairman of the global board of DLA Piper. We're very proud of Carl Vacchetta, a distinguished graduate of this institution and someone who's served his clients and the community with great integrity and skill over that 40-year period. So please join me in again welcoming and thanking Carl Vacchetta for his contributions here today. I'm going to talk about America's role in the 21st century, and as a result, at least in my comments, I will not be mentioning my years in the Senate. Lest anyone think they were not important to me, I ought to begin with a couple of stories about the Senate, because it really was one of the highlights of my life. I entered the Senate under unusual circumstances. I was serving as a federal district court judge in my home state of Maine when my predecessor, Senator Muskie, resigned to become Secretary of State. The announcement was made on a Wednesday in May of 1980, and the governor of Maine on that same day said that on the following Monday he would hold a press conference at the state capitol to announce his choice to complete Senator Muskie's unexpired term. So the next several days were filled with a lot of speculation. My name was not among them. I'd become a federal judge just the previous year. We had a former governor, a former senator, a whole lot of very qualified people. And like almost everyone else in Maine, I went to bed on Sunday evening wondering what the governor was going to do the next day. And then the phone rang and woke me up, and it was the governor on the line. He said, "I'd like you to come down to the state capitol tomorrow noon so I can announce that I'm going to appoint you to complete Senator Muskie's term." I said, "Well, gee, Governor, this is quite a surprise." I said, "It's a big decision. I'd like to have the opportunity to think about it, to talk to my family and friends, and get back to you. How long do I have?" He said, "I'll give you an hour." When I protested that it was not enough time, he said, "Look, if you won't do it, I've got to find someone else, and it's near midnight, and I've only got till noon tomorrow," he said. So he said, "You call me back in an hour." I said, "Okay." So the first thing I did was call my three older brothers. I grew up in a small town in Maine, and I had three older brothers who were very famous athletes in our state and ultimately throughout New England. And then I came along, and I was not as good an athlete as my brothers. In fact, I was not as good as anybody else's brother. Early in life, I began to be known around our small town as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. So I developed an inferiority complex, which stayed with me for a very long time, and a very competitive attitude toward my brothers, bordering on hostility at times. So I called them, I got them all together on the phone, and told them about the governor's call and asked them what they thought I should do. Immediately and unanimously, they urged me not to accept the appointment. As my brother Johnny explained it delicately, he said, "You're a born loser." He said, "Nobody can understand how you got to be a federal judge, and that's a lifetime appointment. You couldn't possibly win a statewide election, so you'd only be serving for a short time. So be happy where you are and call the governor and let him pick a really qualified person to serve in the Senate." I got so darn mad when I hung up that I immediately called up the governor. I said, "Governor, I don't need an hour. I accept. I'll be there tomorrow at noon." So I went to the state capitol the next day. The governor made the announcement, and I immediately boarded a plane and flew to Washington. Swearing in was scheduled for the following day, so on the plane down, I engaged in fantasies. I wondered whether ABC, CBS, and NBC would carry it live, how much attention my swearing in would get. I envisioned a very large ceremony with the other 99 senators paying rapt attention. I got down to the plane landed. I took a taxi up to the Capitol, and before going over to see for the first time what was to be my office, what had been Senator Muskie's office, I thought I'd stop in the Senate chamber. So I went in, and I had a police officer took me and introduced me to the then majority leader. I was obviously not high on his agenda. "Oh, yes, yes," he said. "Come on in," he said. "Come on in, I'll take you into the Senate." So he took me to the Senate, and he said, "We'll swear you in right now." Before I could have a chance to say anything, he interrupted the proceedings. There was a debate going on a bill. He swore me in. It took about 5 seconds. Nobody noticed. And it was my first major disillusionment in the Senate. And then the Senate resumed the debate that was occurring, and almost immediately a vote occurred. For those of you interested in political trivia, I hold the all-time record in American history for having cast a vote the shortest time after becoming a senator, 2 minutes. And that was the first of many informed judgments I made in your behalf and in behalf of the people of Maine. And then the majority leader said to me, he said, "You're kind of lucky." He said, "There's a filibuster going to start here in a few minutes. Why don't you stick around and see what it's like?" He said, "They don't have too often." That was back then. They didn't have too often. So I took my seat in the back, number 100, way in the corner. In a few minutes, the place emptied out. And to my astonishment, I was the only senator in the chamber. There I was with 99 empty chairs and a couple of clerks standing by the side of the Senate chamber, and I thought this was not my mental impression of filibusters. Well, after a while, one senator came in. He gained recognition from the chair, got up, and he said, I want to say a few words on this subject. And he spoke for 6 hours. Since I was the only other person in the chamber, he spoke to me for 6 hours. About halfway through, realizing that I was learning nothing from this discussion, I thought about leaving, but I didn't betray it. I didn't twitch. I didn't move a muscle. I didn't get up. He sensed it somehow, and he came over and positioned himself right in front of me, and he began in the discussion to point his finger in my face as he... And although the gestures bore no relationship to what he was saying... I thought, well, maybe it looks good on television. I got to remember that the first time I give a speech. And so after 6 hours, he called for a vote on a procedural matter. For those of you who may have been in the Capitol when a vote occurs in the Senate, a loud bell rings throughout the Capitol and throughout all the office buildings. Lights flash, and that's a signal to senators, wherever they are, whatever they're doing, they should come into the Senate chamber and vote. They've got 15 minutes to do it. So a few minutes later, into the Senate chamber, poured the other 98 senators. They all cast their votes on this procedural matter, and then they left, including the guy who'd been talking to me. And once again, I was alone in the Senate. Now I was standing in the well of the Senate, not knowing what to do, looking around when another senator came in. He got the floor, and he spoke to me for 6 hours. So this went on all night. By the next morning, I was very tired, I was very hungry, I desperately had to go to the bathroom, and I saw a clerk standing over by the side of the door, and I walked up to him, and I said, "Excuse me, I'm new here." He said, "Senator, that's obvious to everyone." I said, "You know, I'm really tired and I'm hungry. I see these other senators, they don't look so bad when they come in every 6 hours. I said, "Can you tell me, where do they go and what do they do while I'm out here tending to the nation's business?" He said, I'll do better than that. I'll show you. And he took me around in back of the Senate chamber, right there in the Capitol, into a room about the size of this room, where, to my astonishment, I saw 100 narrow canvas folding cots set up of the type you see in emergency shelters. And there, lying there in their clothes, most of them snoring away, were the members of the United States Senate. My second major disillusionment on my first day. It was very crowded, and he said to a senator, "There's an empty cot there. You better grab it." There were no aisles, so I had to climb over other senators to get there. I got very nervous, especially when I looked and saw the first person I had to climb over was Ted Kennedy. As you know, Ted is not a slight fellow. And at that moment, he looked to me like Mount Everest, and so I had to use all of the athletic ability that my brothers insist I don't have to get over Ted without disturbing him, but I did it. But before I could heave a sigh of relief, I looked in on the next cot. Flat on his back, snoring away, was Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. I'd only been there a day, but I was already aware of his reputation as a stalwart defender of heterosexual rights. So I was really, really nervous when I started to climb up because I thought, oh, my God, what if I slip and lose my balance and fall right on top of him here in the nation's capital with 98 other senators present. So very, very slowly and carefully I made my way over, and I got to this empty cot, and I laid down, and I realized that I'd made the biggest mistake of my life, that just a few hours earlier I had been a federal judge, a dignified person. Now here I was lying here with a bunch of old white guys all snoring away and wondering what was in store for me after this initial experience in the Senate, and I began to feel sorry for myself. And as I wallowed in self-pity, I rolled over on this cot, and just a few inches away, I looked into the face of Senator John Warner of Virginia. At that time, Senator Warner was married to Elizabeth Taylor. So I looked at him and I thought, who am I to feel sorry for myself? Here's a guy who could be home, legally in bed with Elizabeth Taylor, and he's spending the night with me. And I realized at that moment that no matter how bad off you've got it, there's always somebody who's got it worse. And you can go through life feeling sorry for yourself and complaining about things, or you can try to do something about them. And I devoted myself after that in the Senate to trying to do something about the problems I saw, and I must say I enjoyed it very much. It was a great experience. One of the great honors of my life to serve the people of Maine in the Senate. And although I'm not going to talk about it today, I didn't want to leave without making that comment about the Senate. I will discuss the subject I've been asked to talk about, and that's America's role in the world in the 21st century. It's obviously an important subject involving our history, our language, and our culture, our wars, our alliances, and most importantly, our democracy. The word is a combination of two Greek words, demos, the people, kratzi, the rule or the reign of. Democracy means literally the rule of the people. Nowhere has that ideal been more fully realized than here in our own country. While our institutions are imperfect, as are all human institutions and all human beings, they function effectively in what is the most important task, and that is placing and keeping sovereignty in the people. In my comments today, I'll make two principal points. The first is that the vast network of alliance among free nations that developed over the past half century under the leadership of the United States, which is now in such disrepair, must be renewed and reinvigorated. It was born out of British and American cooperation in World War II. By late in 1942, the tide of war had begun to change, and far-sighted leaders both in London and Washington saw the need to begin planning for the massive reconstruction that they knew would be necessary following the end of conflict. They began with plans for an international trading system that would make less likely the protectionist policies that they believed had accelerated the slide into depression a decade earlier. And they believed to a person that it was the Depression that led to a series of political events that drew the world into the Second World War. Their goal was realized 6 years later, in 1948, when 57 nations convened in Havana to sign an agreement to create a World Trade Organization. Although the organization was the work primarily of the United States and the UK. And although President Truman signed the treaty, the Senate refused to ratify it. And after 3 years of a losing effort, Truman gave up on the ratification process and instead implemented by executive order those provisions of the treaty that he believed he legally could implement without Senate ratification. And that is how the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, later known by the acronym the GATT, was created. 46 years later, in the last legislative act of my tenure as Majority Leader, the Senate ratified an updated version of the treaty, and the World Trade Organization was created. The British-American cooperation that started in 1942 soon expanded to include other nations and other subjects. International institutions, including the United Nations, were created to secure the peace and to promote stability and to protect human rights. NATO was created. The European Union was founded. Germany and Japan were rebuilt and became democratic and resurgent. All this and more have helped what started as the North Atlantic Alliance to become what, in my judgment, is the most successful political, military, and economic collaboration among nations in all of history. And I'll return to this point again, but before doing so, I want to state my other principal point. It is that for American democracy, power and principle are mutually enhancing and must be firmly and irrevocably bound together. In 1787, 45 men gathered in Philadelphia in a constitutional convention. Their objective was independence and self-governance, and they achieved both. The Declaration of Independence was a powerful statement of the right of self-governance. The first 10 amendments to the Constitution, what we call the Bill of Rights, is to me the most concise and eloquent statement ever written by any human beings anywhere of the right of the individual to be free from oppression by government. Modern concepts of democracy throughout the world rest heavily on these two principles. In the dangerous world of the 21st century, they can be maintained and defended only if those who hold them are strong and well prepared. But my concern is that for too many people in and outside of this country, military power and economic strength are seen as displacing rather than serving our ideals. As we enter the 21st century, American power is ascendant in the world, and yet the American people aren't celebrating, nor is anyone else. To the contrary, poll after poll after poll reports widespread and rising hostility to the United States in every part of the world, among former friends and adversaries alike. Our power is the greatest it's ever been, but our standing in the world is the lowest it's ever been. Never before in our nation's history has our country been held in such low regard all around the world. Many object to what they believe is the unilateralism of the current administration. For others, the United States will always be the one to blame simply because of our role in the world. There have been dominant military and economic powers throughout history. The role carries with it enormous benefits and many problems. In this era of instant communication, every grievance, no matter how local, whether real or imagined, can be a cause of resentment of the dominant power. In the past several years, beginning as Majority Leader and continuing since, I've had the opportunity to meet with political leaders from almost every nation in Europe, from Ireland to Russia, from Scandinavia to the Mediterranean. I've asked each of them this question. Now that the Soviet Union no longer exists and Russia has withdrawn its military forces back to its national territory, do you believe that the United States should withdraw its military forces back to its national territory? Without exception, every European leader answered immediately and emphatically no. Why do some countries want American military forces on their soil? And how can that be reconciled with the hostility to the United States that exists, to which I earlier referred? Obviously, part of the answer lies in power itself. Everyone wants to be on the side of the strong, the side that they perceive to be winning. But for too many people, in and out of the U.S., power increasingly is perceived to be the primary or even the exclusive basis of American influence in the world. I think there's much more involved. Power is clearly important, and we must be prepared to use it, including military force when necessary. A strong economy and a strong military are essential to our security, our prosperity, our very freedom. But in our democracy, power must be deployed in service to our ideals, for it is ideals that always have been the primary basis of American influence in the world. They're not easily summarized, but surely they include the sovereignty of the people, the primacy of individual liberty, the rule of law applied equally to every person in the society, an opportunity for every member of that society. And we must never, ever forget that before the United States was a great military or economic power, it was a great nation because it was ennobled at birth by the adoption of our charter documents to which I've already referred and because of the principles that underlie and motivate our people. The principles set forth in the Declaration and the Constitution guided our country in the early years of nationhood and through the turbulence of the 20th century. And they must guide us now as we engage in the difficult transition from a bipolar world to one in which there is only one superpower. In the near term, we and our allies could face a huge threat in the potential convergence of three dangerous trends: the proliferation of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, the increase in the number of terrorist groups and their decentralization, and the rising tide of hostility to the United States, to which I've already referred. We led the world into the nuclear age, and we have led the effort to contain these weapons with some success and some failure. Among the successes is the reality that several countries with the capacity to develop nuclear weapons have refrained from doing so because they have trusted the American umbrella. Among them, of course, are Japan, Germany, Canada, Australia, South Africa, many others. But the number of countries with nuclear weapons has steadily increased, has reached 9, and continues to grow. The 9 are the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. Iran is trying very hard to make it 10. One perverse result of what we call the war on terror is the increase in and the dispersal of terrorist organizations. Intelligence agencies and experts in the field tell us that they now are much less likely to be centrally controlled, and often we learn of a group from its posting on their website making a claim for some atrocity that's occurred. And as a result, detection, infiltration, and prevention is much more difficult. It is conceivable, and we must plan for the possibility that within a few years a terrorist group will gain access to fissile materials and the know-how to make a nuclear weapon. There is no single policy or act that will prevent that from occurring. But two needs are clear. The first I've already referred to is renewing our alliances, and the second is to significantly improve our intelligence capabilities. Although military force must be used when necessary and appropriate, by itself it is plainly insufficient because this is not a conventional war. It is constantly referred to as the war on terror, but terror is a tactic, not an enemy. The tactic did not begin on September 11th, although that attack was different in scale and consequence. But there are many differences among those who use such tactics. Some have specific political objectives. Some do not. Some are coherent political groups with which dialogue is possible. Some are not. And for some, like Al-Qaeda, the only response must be their total destruction. But it is inaccurate, unhelpful, and self-deluding to lump them all together as though it is a common monolithic foe. More effective intelligence will enable us to be more discerning, to pursue more aggressive preemption of such acts. One result has to be a better balance between collection of information and its analysis. More than 90% of our very large intelligence budget is devoted to collecting information, less than 10% to analyzing it. And as a result, much of it is unused on a timely basis. We simply must do better at timely, incisive analysis, or the mountains of data we collect will be of little value. But even a better organized, more efficient intelligence service will need the coordinated efforts of many other countries. To put it as simply as possible, we will be much more successful if we don't fight this war by ourselves. Some of the worldwide cooperation we achieved after 9/11 has been lost. We need a much greater effort to work with our allies, and particularly with the intelligence and police services in other countries, to take our cooperative counterterrorist activity to a new level. Much of what I've said has become self-evident in Iraq. There's a long history of civilization in the central part of what is now known as Iraq. But the current borders were drawn by the British after the First World War. And the British objective was to repay a political debt which their government felt they had to certain Arab factions for their help during the First World War. They did not seek or consider the views of the people who lived in the regions themselves. And there were many, many unfortunate results. One was that the Iraq, which emerged from that conference, was the product literally of a British civil servant spreading a large map on a conference table and drawing lines on a map to create a country which never previously existed, the country of Iraq. In fact, at the same time, he drew lines to create another country which had never previously existed, and that was Jordan. And as a consequence, what is now Iraq includes a north dominated by ethnic Kurds who are Sunni Muslim by religion, a south by ethnic Arabs who are Shia Muslim by religion, and a center of ethnic Arabs who are Sunni Muslim by religion. Each of those areas was a separate entity called an administrative district under the Ottoman Empire for the 400 years preceding the First World War. Now, the apparent approval of a constitution this week was an important step forward, as will be the parliamentary elections that we hope will be held in the near future. But creating a democratic nation that will serve as a model for the region is proving to be much more complex, much more difficult, much more expensive than the administration anticipated. To win the peace there, to enable us to withdraw, we need all the help we can get in resources and in manpower. We are much more likely to get that help if we can broaden the international coalition in counterterrorist activity. That's why the administration's long-standing unwillingness to permit the United Nations to play a meaningful political role in Iraq was so unwise and short-sighted. The administration belatedly recognized the error, reversed the policy, and has been trying since to get the UN involved. But the way things are going in Iraq makes it very difficult to expand the coalition. In fact, the coalition is steadily shrinking. Perhaps the most significant era was the immediate and total disbandment of the Iraqi army and security forces. This created a huge security vacuum, which the insurgents rushed to fill. The administration, to its credit, recognized that era, has reversed that policy, and is now trying hard to rebuild the Iraqi security forces and to transfer power to Iraqis. It seems to me clear that one of the first things we must do is to scale back the unrealistic expectations with which we entered the war. Our government acted in the belief that Saddam Hussein was a brutal, murderous tyrant whose removal would be in our interest and in the interest of the people of Iraq, that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction that directly threatened us, that we would be greeted as liberators, that it would cost us little or nothing because it would be paid for by Iraqi oil, and that Iraq would become a model democracy that would sweep the Arab world. With the benefit of hindsight, we now can see that they were right about Saddam Hussein and wrong about everything else. No easy option is available. Many Americans disagreed with how we get into the war. Many more now share that view, and some advocate an immediate and total withdrawal. But a slender majority of our citizens still appears to agree that we can't leave until the people of Iraq have a fair chance to freely decide and fairly defend their future by and for themselves. That means a reasonable degree of security and stability and a maximum degree of self-determination. The result will be far from perfect. It is highly unlikely that a democratically elected government in Iraq will be subordinate to American policy. Indeed, because the Shia are by far the largest group, and because the dominant faction within the Shia are very close to Iran, the most likely result will be an Iraq government closely allied with and influenced by Iran precisely at the time that the United States and our European allies confront Iran over its nuclear ambitions. But if we mean what we say about democracy, then we must be prepared to accept the will of the people of Iraq in organizing their government so long as it is truly, freely, and democratically expressed. But no matter what happens in Iraq, even if the result is better than now seems possible, there will not be stability in the Middle East until the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is resolved. That is the central concern of the people in the region. That is the major contributor to anti-American feeling, certainly in the Muslim world. That is the conflict with the potential to spread and threaten the supply of oil to the major economies of the world, including our own. Just a couple of weeks ago, we passed the fifth anniversary of the most recent outbreak of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. Thousands of people have died. Israel's economy has been badly hurt. The Palestinian economy has been destroyed. After the violence broke out, concerned world leaders met in a summit. They agreed that an international commission should be formed, and they asked me to serve as chairman. They hoped that a neutral report on the origins of the violence might help to end it. Unfortunately, as we know, the violence continued. In light of that ongoing violence, I and the other members of our commission focused our recommendations on three objectives: to end the violence, to halt the decline in confidence between the parties, and to resume meaningful negotiation. We were surprised and heartened by the initial response to our report. The government of Israel and the Palestinian Authority both said they accepted it. The Bush administration, the United Nations, the European Union, and most governments in the world endorsed it. But agreements are not self-executing. Saying you're for something isn't enough. You have to do something about it. And no one did anything. And as a consequence, nothing happened with respect to implementation. And we were profoundly disappointed. 2 years later, we were pleased when President Bush announced his plan, the so-called roadmap, which incorporates almost in its entirety our report, and goes a little bit beyond it in terms of the outcome. And we were again, however, disappointed as the roadmap itself stalled. Our report is very long and time doesn't permit a detailed explanation, but I'll mention some of the recommendations that achieved the most attention. We asked that the Palestinian Authority renounce violence, end the incitement to hatred, and arrest and vigorously prosecute all those engaged in terrorist activity. Of the government of Israel, we asked that they withdraw their defense forces back to the positions they were in prior to the outbreak of violence, and that the government immediately freeze all settlement activity. Now, contributing to the difficulty of finding a peaceful resolution to this conflict is the reality that the circumstances and objectives of the two sides are different. The Israelis have a state, but their people live in unbearable fear and anxiety from the horror of suicide bombing attacks. So what they want is security. Security for the people in their ordinary daily lives is their highest priority. The Palestinians, on the other hand, don't have a state, and they want one, an independent, economically viable, geographically contiguous state. That is their overriding objective. I believe, and have so stated directly to each government, that neither can attain its objective by denying to the other side its objective. The Palestinians are simply not going to achieve a state until the people of Israel have some reasonable degree of security. The tactic of terror is not only morally reprehensible, it is politically counterproductive for Palestinians. With each suicide bomb attack, the prospect of a Palestinian state is deferred, not advanced. And the tactic is destructive of Palestinian civil society, as we're seeing now in the outbreaks of violence and criminal activity, the decline of law and order, and it's also badly harmful to the reputation of the Palestinian people worldwide. But there must be made available to Palestinians a clear alternative of a nonviolent path to a Palestinian state living in peace alongside a Jewish state. The two-state solution that, despite all of the difficulty of recent years, a majority of people on both sides say they still support. To put it simply, the president and other leaders must assure the Palestinians that if they finally do what they should have done a long time ago, make a real all-out effort to suppress terrorist acts against Israeli citizens, that the president and other leaders will insist on full implementation of the roadmap, including the creation of a Palestinian state. In turn, Palestinians must accept the reality that the Israeli demand for security is as real and as necessary as is their demand for a state. Both are more likely to occur if a context can be created in which meaningful negotiation can take place. The parties can't do that themselves because their mutual mistrust is total. The culture of peace, so carefully nurtured over the previous decade, has been shattered, and it's been replaced by a sense of futility, of despair, of betrayal, and of the inevitability of conflict. From my experience in Northern Ireland, I formed the conviction that there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings. I saw it happen in Northern Ireland, and with determined and persevering American leadership, it can happen in the Middle East. It cannot happen without an active, persevering effort by the United States government, because there is no other entity on earth, government or non-government, that has the capacity to create the context in which meaningful and successful negotiation can take place and that can guarantee implementation of an agreement, which, as I noted earlier, is very difficult. It's hard to get agreements in these conflicts. It's even harder to get implementation of agreements. There's one other point that I believe is so important that I want to make special mention of it. I recall clearly my first day in Northern Ireland 10 years ago. I was taken to see for the first time a huge wall which physically separates the two communities in Belfast, the capital and largest city of Northern Ireland. It's 30 feet high, topped in places with barbed wire. It goes right across streets, right through buildings, and is an ugly reminder of the intensity and duration of the conflict. And ironically, it's called the Peace Line. On the first morning, I met with nationalists who are primarily Catholic on their side of the wall. That afternoon, I met with Unionists, primarily Protestant, on their side of the wall. They had no communication. They'd been in conflict for a long time, but to my surprise, their messages were the same. In Belfast and in the other urban areas of Northern Ireland, they told me there was a high correlation between unemployment and violence. They said that where men and women had no opportunity and no hope, they were much more likely to take the path of violence. As I sat and listened to them, they were all powerful orators. I said to them later that they'd all make great senators because they really talk a long time. I thought I could be in any major city in the world. Despair is the fuel for instability and conflict everywhere. Hope is essential to peace and stability. Men and women everywhere need income to support their families, and they need the satisfaction of doing something worthwhile and meaningful in their lives. The conflict in Northern Ireland is obviously not exclusively or even primarily economic. It involves religion, national identity, clashing territorial claims. But if there is to be peace and stability, people need hope. There can't be hope without opportunity, and that requires economic growth and job creation. This is a powerful argument for democracy, because the combination of democratic political institutions and free market economic structures plainly offers the best hope for the billions of people worldwide who suffer from poverty and despair. But economic growth cannot be just a product of democracy. It is essential for the success of democracy, because to a man without a job, to a woman who can't feed or care for her children, to a young adult who lacks the skills or knowledge to get a job in the competitive economic landscape of the world, debates about democracy are irrelevant. They worry about coping day to day, about eating, about feeding their children. Democracy means the rule of the people, but it also must mean opportunity for all of the people. And I close with a personal anecdote that, to me, makes this last point. As I said earlier, I had the great privilege of serving as a federal judge before I entered the Senate. In that position, I had great power. It was the only job I've ever held where I had any power. When you're Senate Majority Leader, really all you have is the opportunity to go and ask, beg senators to do things that they should be doing without being asked. When I was chairing the peace negotiations, I couldn't order anyone to do anything. But when I was a federal judge, I could, and every day did, order people to do things. And I'm pleased to tell you that, without exception, they always did exactly what I ordered. And I really loved that part of the job. But what I most enjoyed was when I presided over what are called naturalization ceremonies. They're citizenship ceremonies. A group of people who'd come from every part of the world, who'd gone through the required procedures, gathered before me in a federal courtroom in my home state of Maine, and there I administered to them the oath of allegiance to the United States, and by the power vested in me under our Constitution and law, I made them Americans. It was always a very emotional ceremony for me because my mother was an immigrant. She never went to school. She could not read or write. She could barely speak English. And she worked for 40 years on the night shift in textile mills in our hometown. My father was the orphan son of Irish immigrants. He never knew his parents, spent years in an orphanage, left school after the fourth grade, and he was a janitor at a local school. But because of their efforts, and more importantly, because of the openness of American society, I, their son, was able to go on and get an education and to become the majority leader of the United States Senate. After every one of these naturalization ceremonies, I spoke personally with each of the new Americans, individually or in family groups. I asked them why they came, how they came. Their stories were as different as their countries of origin, but all were inspiring. Most of us are Americans by an accident of birth. All of them are Americans by an act of free will, often at great risk and cost to themselves and their families. Through the differences, there were some common themes, best expressed by a young Asian man who, when I asked why he came, replied in very slow and broken English, "I came, Judge," he said, "because here in America, everybody has a chance." Think about the fact that a young man who had been an American for 10 minutes, who could barely speak English, was able to sum up the meaning of our country in a single, simple sentence. America is freedom and opportunity. And our role in the world ought to be to preserve it for ourselves and make it possible for others. The 21st century may be, like most centuries in the past, a time of war, of famine, of oppression, of injustice. But it also could be a time when the dominant power uses its strength carefully and commits its people, its prestige, and its power to a great and noble vision, a world largely at peace with freedom, education, opportunity, and prosperity, extending to more and more people throughout the world. That's our challenge, and we should make it our destiny. Thank you very much for having me here today.
For just a few questions, and we've got microphones out in the audience that we will need to be using.
We'll bring the microphones around, too. We have a microphone on each side of the room. Just raise your hand. We'll bring the mic to you.
Senator, 35 years ago, about this time, I was starting law school, and we were in the middle of Vietnam, and I'm sure you've heard this parallel.
Yes.
Do you have any comment for the rank and file of American citizens about what the history, what the lesson of Vietnam can tell us about the future in Iraq? We want to believe our government. We want to support our troops. We want to think we're going to get out of this. But the lesson of Vietnam and my generation left us with very troubling images.
It is. Historical parallels are important, but, of course, they're never exact. And while I think there are many similarities, I believe that there are some compelling differences. And therefore, I conclude, as I believe a slender majority of Americans still believe, that we ought to stay for a while longer, although not a great deal longer, to create the conditions in which there is at least a fair and reasonable chance for Iraqis to govern themselves. Whatever the circumstances of getting into the conflict, and as I made clear in my opening remarks, it is obvious that our government was completely in error in most of the assumptions and statements made. What is not so clear is the extent to which that was simply relying on bad information and acting in good faith, or whether there was misstatement, deliberate misstatement. We don't know that yet. There hasn't been, at least to me, any sufficient opening of a record to reach that conclusion. But the important thing is that we discard the illusions with which we entered, and now, realistically, with a much lower level of expectation, try to accomplish a handover in a circumstance in which it is reasonably possible. The one troubling analogy is that it is very clear that the presence of large numbers of American troops is itself a significant factor in the insurgency. And so you're trying to balance, as you often do in public policy, very sharply conflicting and competing objectives. But I believe that as of now, there is still a sufficient basis for belief that there can be a democratic expression that enables them to assume their proper right of self-determination and allows us to withdraw. And, in fact, I believe the administration has already made a political decision to significantly withdraw, to significantly reduce our troop level next year, primarily not because of the Iraqi election, but because of the American election. Going into the November 06 midterm election with the status quo would be catastrophic for the administration, so I think it's almost certain that you'll see at least some significant withdrawal. I don't think it'll be total, but there can be a very significant withdrawal, and I believe there will be. And let us hope and pray that the consequence is one that does give the people of Iraq the opportunity that they deserve. As I said in my remarks, and I repeat, it is very clear that, and we shouldn't seek to diminish the significance of this point, that Saddam Hussein was a brutal, murderous tyrant whose removal was the right thing to do. The problem attends itself not to that aspect of it, but to the other aspects which I described.
Question over here on the other side of the room.
Thank you. I really appreciate your comments and insights from the experiences that you've had. But I was wondering if you might be able to speak a little bit with regards to what's happening in Central America and South America. And my question specifically applies to Venezuela and Hugo Chavez in regards to the fact that that is a democratically elected government recognized throughout the world, yet our government has taken a position opposed to that government. And you spoke so eloquently about the fact that what's important for governments to provide is hope for people, to eliminate despair, to provide opportunities for people's well-being. And when you look at Venezuela, for an example, and the trends in South America, you are seeing governments being elected, but in fact beginning to address the concerns of their country by addressing hunger, poverty, education, health care, in a way that doesn't follow our economic model. And my question to you is it in our interest to support, to oppose, or why is our government opposing those democratically elected governments that are trying to meet the very needs that you say our country is doing?
Well, I am an imperfect spokesman for the current administration. I prefer to address myself on a broader scale to respond to your question. Each of us as individuals wakes up every morning determined to do the right thing. We're not going to tell a lie. We're not going to do anything wrong. We're not going to cheat anybody out of anything. And each of us as imperfect humans fails every day. And we get up the next morning and we're determined again. Now, no one would suggest that the proper answer is to lower our aspirations to the level of our actions. Rather, we should keep our aspirations high and try constantly to raise our actions to meet the level of our aspirations, even though we know as human beings, fallible, we're going to make mistakes. So it is, I believe, with nations. We regularly, throughout our history, have preached democracy, but when it has proven to be inconvenient to immediate political needs, we have acted in an inconsistent manner. That is not, in fairness, unique to this administration, although I believe that the worldwide impression is one of a self-righteousness and arrogance that is greater in degree, at least, than people previously discerned from our country. And that's the great problem that we face everywhere. I spoke at a college in Colorado yesterday, and the first question I was asked by a student was, well, how can you preach democracy when you're showering money and favors on the government of Pakistan, which is, of course, a government that took power by military coup? The answer is, of course, that there is this ongoing tension between holding and advocating principles that collide with immediate political, economic, or other interests. And we have to do two things. One is not to lower our aspirations, but also not to flagellate ourselves over the fact that we're not perfect. Now, I don't have to agree with the administration's policy in Latin America. The policy basically is we're for democracy so long as it produces a government that we like, that follows policies that we like. But the very essence of self-determination is what the words say, to determine for yourselves what your future is. And if people choose a certain way, so long as it's freely and democratically expressed, they ought to be able to pursue those policies. We're perfectly within our right to oppose policies, but I don't think we should be seeking to undermine democratic governments because we don't agree, we don't like the leaders, or we don't agree with their policies. But it's a very difficult task, and I think on balance we've done reasonably well as a country and a society. Think of it in domestic terms. We revere our Constitution. I praised it here, and I don't think anybody here is going to get up and denounce the American Constitution. But the fact is that when it was adopted, the Constitution limited the right to vote to adult white males who own property. A black person was explicitly considered not to be a person under the American Constitution as originally adopted. Now, it took 75 years and the bloodiest war in our history to correct that grievous error and extend the right to vote to all adult males. It took another 60 years and a ferocious political struggle that's hard for us to conceive of now to extend the right to vote to women. It wasn't until the 60s when we passed the Voting Rights Act and other civil rights acts that we really genuinely had the opportunity for every American, whatever the color of his or her skin, to have the basic right to vote. And it wasn't until I was in the Senate in the 1990s that we passed a law that made it possible for persons with disabilities for the first time to enjoy full and meaningful opportunity to live. So we've improved, we've altered expanded our definition of human and civil rights at home, and we've improved and altered our definitions of principles and the policies that pursued them. Can you find errors? Without a doubt. And we could all make up a long list of them. It's not just Pakistan. It's Saudi Arabia. In Turkey, a democratic Muslim government, 95% of the people opposed helping the United States in Iraq in the war. And our government got mad as heck at the Turkish government because they wouldn't force it through, even though they had 95% disapproval. That's democracy in action. Sometimes you get results you don't like. You know, Churchill said democracy is the worst possible form of government except for anything else human beings have tried. And so we have to be patient and do the best we can and try to move forward. But I don't think we ought to be too harshly critical. You can be critical of the current administration, but don't be too critical of the country as a whole as a result of what we're doing.
I think we ought to stop there. Okay. We have the senator for only a few more minutes, really, and okay. I want to give everybody an opportunity to shake his hand and ask your questions out in the pavilion for the reception. Thank you so much for this opportunity. What a wonderful event.